Recording in progress.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're live.
Well, OPEC Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. S&P futures are up 20.33. NASDAQ futures up 311. We're starting the week to the upside here. I guess because nothing crazy happened over the weekend, which is always a cause to, nothing really crazy happened over the weekend, which is a cause to celebrate, I guess. Do we have Mr. John Lee?
We have Mr. John Lee.
Yes. Was that? Are you saying the pond would be good for him? Is that what that lead-in meant? The pool, the pond, you know?
I was more to you. I think you're better, you know, the pond, natural springs.
Well, there's a guy that built this house out by Odd. I don't know if I would exactly call it a house, but it's quite the place. And he had a little pond on there, and he made the pond a lot bigger. has like a little rowboat on there. He's going to throw a fish out there and catch him and throw him back. I don't know what he's going to do with that, but big pool next to the pond, so he's got the... You can go right and jump from the pool into the pond if you wanted to. House got to be 25,000 square feet. That's what you need, Jen.
Yeah, no. I tell you what, we have two. And I think initially my partner said they're beautiful, don't ever touch them. And I think if we could cement them in, she probably would turn a blind eye.
Well,
maintenance nightmares.
Oh, this is like a real pond, though. You guys got the little rack ponds. You got to keep clean.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I don't know what the... So the dude's house, he has a gatehouse with the enter and exit, but it's a house. It's not a community. I mean, it's not like a whole area where you got a, you know, a gated community type of thing. But the guy has the ability to put a guard in the house from coming to his place.
How big is this place? Jesus.
I'm going to say, I think it's 23,000 square feet, maybe.
Well, that's a nice summer home, but come on, let's not get too excited.
What about six-car garage, not a big, you know, house in the back for the in-laws if you don't want to talk to them type of thing?
That sounds like Jimmy's summer house.
Yeah. That's a big thing. So did you, the weather this weekend, could it have been any worse? I mean, they played that game in Philly in 98-degree heat, didn't they, Jimmy, or something?
Yes, they did.
And I watched the game last night. It was, I'm not really into soccer that much. The game last night was very interesting. The only thing I didn't see the foul where the guy got the red card, but then Britain had a play for, the whole second half. It seemed only 10 people. And that was interesting.
That was a wild game.
Yeah, the first half was, there was a period in there of 5 or 6 minutes. It was more action I've ever seen in a soccer game. And then second half, guys were just, they kept making rushes at the goalie. The goalie played unbelievably on Britain. Goalkeeper, sorry. Anyway, interesting stuff. I don't think there's joy. And they had 7,500 people watching the game outside at Aurora last night, Hispanic people. I don't think they were too happy about the end. But anyway, so.
I do enjoy the way we've all gotten into the World Cup.
I haven't gotten into it. It's just soccer.
I think it's been exciting all the way around. It's like you and I are going to try to watch it tonight.
I'm going to watch a little bit of it, but a couple of games have been so freaking boring. I don't know how anybody could watch them. The France versus whoever the hell game, and all the guy kept saying is how good France was. They look like they sucked. They didn't do anything. They got a shot on goal for the first three quarters of the game. How are they that good? And then they won on a cheap call. How fixed was that?
So, I can't believe you're not talking about, thank God Donald Trump has saved the American team.
Yeah. It's a... he's busy, yeah. I'll say that for him.
Yeah.
They had a guy on... but I don't know if it was his minister in his interior yesterday or where the hell he was, talking about the reflecting pond. The same exact words used by Trump in his bull bleep. The guy... Do they have a minister of propaganda or what that writes all this stuff and you can't go off the script?
It is
yes.
They're dumb like foxes.
Well, the guy kept talking about. He said, "Well, are we saying somebody cut a 350-foot slit into the bottom?" Well, not exactly. We're saying that all kinds of cuts went into the thing and they equaled 350 feet. Well, it's not exactly what you said. He said, "Do you actually have any evidence?" Then he launched into this whole thing about how they're putting in this state-of-the-art camera system, both on the Lincoln Memorial and on the reflecting pond. Guy says, "Wait a minute. See, don't actually have any evidence, any camera footage from what you're saying." "Oh, we got evidence, but you don't have any." "Don't worry. We got people. We'll all come out in court." Okay, but is the exact same words that Trump used the other day. Is somebody writing this stuff for these people? They must be.
Tom, of course they are.
But who's the minister of propaganda?
You've got Stephen Miller. Okay, Stephen Miller's, and you've got a group of folks that are extremely focused in and on defending this current regime. I'll use my words carefully there. So yeah, they do. I mean, they're very good at it. They've, and it's the old adage, and they've proven. If you say something long you know, enough times, people will believe it.
Well, they just arrested, who's this guy they arrested overseas that they claim that he's funding all the liberal groups that are funding people that go to the demonstrations and stuff?
Who's that? No, I didn't see that.
Jimmy, see if you can find that, will you? Some guy from, he's from France or some damn place, and they claim he's been funding, like, the people that show up at the anti-ICE rallies and stuff. You know, the whole story is those people are only there because they're getting paid, right? Which is total
it's
bull.
It's usually George Soros.
No, it's not. It's definitely not Soros. Some other guy. I would definitely recognize that. But so then evidently, in Washington, they had this group with Confederate flags and, like, you know, total right-wing Nazism type of thing run up and down the mall this weekend. So they asked whoever the guy was, I think the Interior Minister, and he goes, well, and these guys are allegedly the financiers. They were born in the thing that happened in Charlotte, Virginia. Remember that, that fiasco?
Yeah.
They were born there. So they claim these guys are funding a lot of the real right-wing, you know, basically fascist stuff. And he goes, well, everybody gets a chance to, you know, his First Amendment rights. But they're not willing to give the First Amendment rights to the liberal guys, but these guys,
not at all.
But anywho, the soccer? I'm surprised. Some game. I was really stunned with the Mexico Britain game because there was so much action. The French game, they didn't do anything. They didn't get, how do you be the supposedly the best team and not get a shot on goal for the first? I mean, I thought that game was like watching paint dry. Norway, I didn't watch. I hear that was real good. Jimmy, you watched that one, right?
Yes, I did. Norway was good, and Hedland, he's one of the top scorers in the Premier League, ended up scoring again two more goals. He's now tied for the Golden Boot with Messi and Mbappe. The guy's good. He plays for Manchester City. He looks like a Viking. He's huge.
One of my nephews or somebody said if Mbappe didn't have his name, didn't get a chance to do penalty kicks, they'd have benched him or something. He hasn't played anywhere near like they said he's supposed to. But anywho, it's just whenever you see something like the guys on TV, my Notre Dame guys, all they do is bitch and moan because they think Herb Street, Eastern Ohio State doesn't like the Irish very much. Okay, fine. I could care less if an announcer doesn't like my football team. The guy who's the guy with the slick back hair, who's on the desk, the FIFA desk. The guy kept talking.
Zoltan.
Yeah, the guy kept talking about France. Oh, they're clearly the superior team. And even after the half, where they didn't do anything. Well, clearly you can see they're controlling the whole game. And anytime they want to turn it on and start getting some goals, they can. And I'm sitting there going, they ended up winning on a penalty kick on a cheap call. How does that work? I mean, if you were a guy thinking things were fixed, let's see. How does the best team advance with the and how many people really wanted? I mean, how many people wanted Paraguay? How many people from Paraguay are here for this thing? It's Paraguay is the most, by far the, I'll say the least GNP. They're the only place in South America without a port, right? They're in the interior of the country, I believe.
Paraguay has a port.
Where? No, they don't. Look at the map.
I mean, that is kind of the magic of the World Cup. Is you've got the Dominican Republic, you know, going up against, a European powerhouse, and sometimes, or, you know, a very small country going up against powerhouses, and sometimes almost taking it away, like we saw this weekend. That's kind of the magic of the whole World Cup. I mean, there's only 10 guys, and it's not like, you know, American football where you have to have, you know, a what's the phrase they use in the military? A logistics trail to field a team.
Oh, like hockey. I mean, they're all like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so that is, I think.
Well, Cape Verde almost won, right?
That's right.
I'm not saying, was that game, did it look like that one was rigged too, or was that one
No.
It was legit? But
yeah, I mean, going back to the, thank God our wonderful president, as people can tell, I'm not a fan. I can't stand him. But that red card, I when I saw it, I mean, it did look like a little excessive. It did. Purposely didn't.
It was no intent to injure on that stuff. I mean, I don't think so. I think a yellow would have been sufficient, but that would be me. So you're out for the rest of that game and the next game, right?
Yeah, that's what it was.
So he's going to be out. Well, he was going to be out this game, and now he's not. Is he that much of a difference maker? I mean,
I think he is. He's the best player right now on the team.
All right. Well, it'd be nice to see him win. If they win, then where do they play next, Jimmy? They're playing tonight in Seattle?
Seattle.
And then if they win, where do they go?
That's a good question. The final will be in New York, New Jersey. So it could be Miami. I don't think Mexico has any more games.
I was going to ask you, does Mexico have any more games? I don't think they do. And there's no more in Canada either, right?
I believe that is correct.
Well, by the way, I'm looking right at the map here. Paraguay is right in the middle of the country. They have no port.
That is correct.
Well, how the hell did they end up with no port? They must have hopefully at least got a river of some kind. Brazil goes right around him, right?
Brazil.
Yeah, they're right next to Uruguay.
Yeah,
Uruguay. And
Uruguay.
I think it's the Rio de Plata goes through it.
Uruguay is a. It's a carve out from Argentina. Their borders are Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina.
Oh, okay. I was wrong about that.
So it's hard to imagine somebody kind of in the middle. Actually, I don't think Bolivia has a port either.
Bolivia is landlocked.
Yeah. Ew. That's not good. So we've been talking a lot about, you know, the market and the labor report last Friday or last Thursday. God, Carl was all over that labor report, and I thought it was kind of bad. I mean, when I say bad, let me get the numbers out here. Now, of course, if Carl's listening, he's going to be shuddering because I'm going to be looking at the A1. But the amount of people that are not working, we don't know why, is like at an all-time. I mean, I don't know if it's as bad as COVID, but let me look. I think it might be.
Tom, say it again. It's bad as what?
Is the COVID situation in terms of how many people were not working? But I'll get the numbers here. It's worth going over again because it was really. I mean, Carl was talking about the different groups that are losing and versus winning, and it didn't seem very good. But market doesn't seem to care. Market's zeroing in on the interest rate piece, which they should, and to a certain extent. But I've got here. This is the June number, right? Now, so I'll go across this bottom line here, just so everybody understands what the deal is. Column one, 275 million people. That's the amount of the population that is the civilian, non-institutional population. That's essentially over the age of 16. Right. So those are the people that are available to be working. You're not in a jail. You're not in a mental institution. 275. Of that, 169 million are working. I'm sorry. You've got 169 million people that are considered working or looking for work. Right now, here's the part. Whenever you hear somebody, this is a kind of a blanket statement. Whenever you hear somebody talk about the unemployment rate, like I'm going to talk about it. Just completely brand him an idiot, okay? Because here's why I say that. There's 169 million people that are essentially, okay, that's 169 million people that are either employed or looking for work, all right? So there's 162 million people that are employed, all right? There's 7 million looking for work, and there's 105,000,808 that are, we don't know what they're doing. They could be in school, they could be, in mama's basement, they could be retired, whatever. But, so there's really 112 million people that are not working. And out of that group, we magically pull 7 million and we say, they're the ones that are looking for work. So the unemployment rate is actually down. which is such BS. Because if you look at the amount of combined people working versus non-working, you're up to 112.9 that are not working, which is, so 59% of the population that's available to work is working. That is incredibly low. Say we knew somebody who was unemployed. You go get your unemployment insurance. The minute you come off the unemployment insurance, they're counting you as not looking anymore. Well, that's idiotic. Because how do they? You might be looking harder because now it's been, your 6 months are up. But this number, this 59, I don't think we can survive. Let me go back to COVID. COVID is 20. We got down to 56.8 during COVID when everybody was getting, nobody went to work, okay? But normally, this number is over, if you go back to 2008, 2007, it's 63, 63.1, 62.7. So it comes down to how many people, now granted, a lot of these people are retired, and a lot of them are in school, but this number gets down to 55, 56 generally. I don't see how that many people working could pay for all the people that aren't working. For us to be really healthy, that number needs to be like, if that number was 64 or so, I think that a lot of our deficit issues would go away. Not all of them, because we spend money on everything.
Rising tide, I mean, it floats all boats here. I mean, that's an old phrase.
Yeah, but we're definitely going the wrong way here.
Increasing, I'm going to change subjects here. No, I guess I won't, about the Democratic Party and democratic socialists. But no, a rising economy, if we had a 10% increase in our employment rate, what would that do to our to the deficit?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Every
it solves a lot of problems.
It would solve a lot of the problem. And since we refuse to tax people with inordinate wealth, really, well, in some cases you do, but in some cases you don't. We don't seem to know what we're doing. And a minute that somebody looks at the current situation and says, gee, it's kind of screwed up, they're immediately branded a communist or a socialist by a person who doesn't even know what that means. I mean, we really are in kind of a mess here in terms of where we're going with this thing. And, I don't know, where we're headed, but we need to make some changes in the tax law, I think, and not just grabbing money from people, but I think we need, and we're not going to do it. We're not close to doing it. I think we got to change the capital gains rates. I think we got to change a lot of stuff, but with just a little bit of common sense. I think the capital gains rate should be indexed. I mean, if somebody, buys something a year ago, a baseball card or a stock, and it doubles in a year, why should your rate be that much lower than a regular rate? But if you bought it 30 years ago, for $50 and now it's 100, you didn't make any money, did you? Adjusted for inflation? I mean, why should the capital gains rates be the same for a 1 year investment as it does for a 100 year investment? I mean, it's insane. But try and get it to change. Rostenkowski came and spoke at the SIBO when I was on the board, and he goes, why don't we index the capital gains rates? He goes, every time I bring this up, I can't get anywhere from anybody. And he was the head of the Ways and Means Committee, for God's sake. Because everybody's dead set against it. Okay, why? I mean, I don't know.
What would that do?
Well, it would take the... It would just be a gradual approach. I mean, right now, if you're a year and a day, it's a capital gain, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you buy something at $50 and you sell it for $150, and you've added a year and a day, why do you get, like half the rate? Well, but if you bought it 40 years ago and you sell it at 50 and you sell it for 150, you haven't even made any money, really. Why should you pay anything? I mean, it works both ways. I'm not just saying it is a way to increase tax. I'm just saying make it fair. Like Rodney, hey, make it fair, will you? The idea, and then you've got the piggy move up, where if you croak and you give the money to your, or the stuff to your kid, he gets the new basis. Nobody ever pays anything on it. Well, that's crazy. Why? Somebody, there's a gain there somewhere. Now, if you indexed it, it shouldn't be the huge amount, but it should be something. Why are these companies so big? They're so big because they don't pay anybody any dividends. Well, guess what? Raise the rate on the corporations the same as individuals, but have the dividends be tax deductible. send the money back to the owners. Instead of having these massive, you know, management class people that think they own the world, and they're not even really an owner, for God's sake. There's a lot of things we could
do. Yeah, no, I agree. No, I think that it, you know, what I see happening is the people are in love with, you know, whether this works or not. You know, the for our next election, I think we will have some pretty stark choices. You'll probably have MAGA Lite. I think they will not be as. And I think that the Democrats will be further to the left. So it's going to be a pretty interesting
time.
Why
can't we get somebody to represent the 80% of the people that are in the middle?
Yeah. And so, well, as a centrist Democrat or centrist Republican, whatever I am now, I'm completely homeless. I'm not like the people downtown San Francisco.
Yeah.
I walk around, I've got nowhere to go.
Nope. Got nowhere to go.
Into a very, very close friend of mine yesterday, and she is a she's a self-avowed, I mean, she's smart as a tack, self-avowed democratic socialist, right? And
what does that even mean?
And, you know, and this is, you know, probably as close a friend as you can have. And I just said, you know, I keep talking, you know, most of Americans are moderate. They're center right, center left. And she doesn't matter. You know, they're I don't know what's going to happen.
What would you say, what does that even mean? What are her beliefs? We say, because they're branding these people all these names. What does that mean?
Well, a democratic socialist is, I think, frankly, just a new tag for a populist movement, in my opinion.
Okay, what does that mean?
And basically that means, you know, they want universal health care. They want a higher tax rate for people with income. They want, you know, much better, actually, I saw the list here the other day. They want unions, you know, to be encouraged. So let me bring it up, and I'll let you know. I'll tell you.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't on both sides.
And they're extremely Democrat. They're extremely anti-Israeli, which, you know, I'm not pro-Israeli anymore, anyways. So fair enough on that.
Well, I'm very pro-Israel in the sense that they are our allies, and we don't want them going down, and they deserve a place to live. I don't know that they get to. When it crosses over into this intense Zionism, I don't know if I go there. That's, you know, so that's where I am. I mean, I think I can be pro-Israeli and not pro-Netanyahu, just like I can be pro-American and not pro-Trump. I mean, isn't that the way you're supposed to be able to do things? Or we don't do that anymore.
I think that Israel right now is Zionist.
Well,
so,
the leader is, and his people, he's in charge. But I mean, if the war ends, he might go to jail.
They also have a big issue. I mean, they've got an outsized, to be polite, influence in American politics. So, I mean, whose fault is that? That's our fault. You know, I'm like the Democratic Socialist of America, and I don't see a list here. Capitalist is a system designed by the owning class to exploit the rest of us for their own profit. We must replace it with democratic socialism, a system where ordinary people have a real voice in our workplaces, neighborhoods, and society. Well, that doesn't say a lot, does it?
I think
that many avenues that feed into the democratic road to socialism.
Well, it's a question of what people see in their reaction to it. We're talking about, and I think one of the things that, I don't know if it's...
Oh, here we go. We want to win radical reforms like single-payer Medicare for all. I'm all for that. Defunding the police, refunding communities, I'm not for that. The Green New Deal, whatever, I'm not sure what that means. In a transition to a freer, more just life. Well, I tell you what, this is about as...
It's not very well thought through.
You could drive a truck through that. Anyways,
that's insane.
So going back to your original issue, Chief, And that is that, am I anti-Israel? No. Am I anti-Zionist? Absolutely. And, you know, shame on us for letting a country that's theoretically an ally lead us around by the nose.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Iran's not a good place. So, I mean, they are for sure, they're diametrically opposed to us. I mean, we don't want, going back to our 250th anniversary, the last thing we want is a bunch of religious zealots throwing people in jail because they're not wearing scarves and running around doing that to other people. I mean, they are as far away from us as anybody could be. So it's not like they're good people. Now, how they manage to keep that group, which probably comprises 10% of the population, it's sort of like China, manages to keep everybody else under their control through incredible secret police and stuff. So I'm no fan of the Iranians whatsoever. I mean, and they've caused trouble all over the damn place. So that part, I get. I just, how you deal with it is you know, up to, for debate. And I don't really have an issue with the nuclear program going downhill over there. I don't. I mean, how you accomplish that, I don't know. I mean, you could bomb the hell out of them, or you could pester the hell out of them, like the Obama thing. And I think that was actually fairly effective. Nothing's perfect. But you look at this Democratic stuff, and I listen to these people. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I mean, I guess he's the hero of a lot of these people.
He's the patron saint.
Well, you know what? You know, if I was gonna do anything to Bernie, I wouldn't want to harm him or anything. I'd ship the guy a calculator. All this stuff sounds good, and none of it adds up. It has nothing to do with whether we are single payer or paid on our own. It has to do with how much we pay for stuff. It's 21% of the population right now, between all the people paying. It's 21% of our GDP is going for healthcare. And guess what? They're not doing a very good job. Other countries seem to do a better job at 10 or 11%. So I don't care who's paying. It doesn't really matter. if the pill you're buying that costs them 50 cents, you're paying 10 bucks for it. The idea that as long as somebody else pays, it's okay, is stone-cold ignorant, Bernie or whoever. It's not okay. That's the problem. If it was 50 cents, you could pay it yourself. But it's not. So the idea that if we can shift this off to either an insurance company or the government, all's okay, is economically very ignorant. I'll say that. It just is. Am I right or wrong? But it just, that dog doesn't hunt. Nobody can afford to pay it. That's the problem. Right?
No, that part's true.
The idea, Sweden is, quote, socialistic, okay? And they know how to define it, and that's what they want, and that's what they have. And it works for them. It's not my brand of ball. Certainly, a guy who traded on the trading floor for 20 years, that's not my brand of ball. I happen to think that competition is way better, and people have to have some sort of an incentive for doing stuff. But Sweden's not paying $50,000 for a chemo that you could get for $1,500 in another country. That's why it works for them. It has nothing to do with who pays. It's how much you pay. Right? I mean, the idea is, as long as somebody else pays, it's okay. That's stone cold.
Yeah, no, I see. You know, I'm trying, our experiences when we lived in the UK, National Health Service, highly maligned, and even the most conservative Brit would fight to the death to keep it. It's highly popular. And I don't know how they fund it. I don't know whether it's through national tax or not, but I thought it was I know that Britain is not, the poster child for anyone right now. But when we were there,
we listened to Trump, he doesn't like him.
Oh no, Britain does have a lot of problems right now.
Well, so does everybody.
The healthcare we had was superb. Superb.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's how you run it and how much you're paying for it. It's not necessary. System here used to be, I mean, when I was actually, I'm not talking about me, but there's a dude. Well, my dad was a policeman, okay? They didn't make any dough. And when I was born, I mean, they went to the hospital. My mother was in there 6 days. They paid the bill. One of the guys, a listener, I don't know if he's still a listener, sent me his bill from Little Company of Mary in 1953. His mother was in Little Company for 5 or 6 days when he was hatched. And it didn't cover the doctor, but it covered the birthing room, the whole week, the whole bit. Guess what the bill was?
Well, probably $100.
$240.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, for 6 days.
He compared from 1953. I mean, that's... I see your point, but I mean, that's...
Well, no, the point is, a regular person had a baby and paid the bill. Now what does it cost? $15,000? $20,000? $25,000?
Yeah.
I mean, so the regular person can't pay the bill. You can't just write it. I mean, I'm guessing my dad was making... What was the... Jimmy, see if you can find it. What was the salary of a Chicago policeman in 1952? I'm going to guess $1,200? $1,500, maybe? What do you think it could have been? Yeah, it could have been much more than that. Jimmy, can you find that? I know you're good at this. But I mean, what are you doing? Now it's what? For a day and a half? The incredible way people... When I was in grad school, the University of Chicago had the only... Now there's a bunch of them. They were the only business... We have Mr. Flanagan. He could pile in here. It was the only MBA school that had a major in, well, a concentrate in hospital management. This was back in, you know, there was only one school that had an MBA in hotel management. Can you name that one?
Goddamn, I remember it. There was real two famous ones. One in Switzerland and one here.
No, it was in the UNLV. University of Las Vegas. Go figure. Anyway, so we did a lot of study on that. And when Ronald Reagan, Dutch, everybody's hero, right? In the day, you ended up, at that time, if you went in the hospital and had a baby, it was 5 days, okay? Now, what is it? Is it two? I don't know what it is now, but it's having had babies. I think it was 5 days back in the day.
Yeah, now, you can get out in the day.
But now, here's where it all starts. You think a hospital, this is 1970, whatever, and I bet it hasn't changed until today. How do you figure out a hospital decides how much it is for a night to stay there?
Don't know.
Well, what would be the dumbest way to do it? I mean, I'm an old cost accountant, so they take the total amount of money they spend, divide it by the amount of patient nights, and that's the number.
Actually, I'm trying to find an article to talk about here. Is what I'm trying to do.
It's so stone cold ignorant. It's scary. I mean, the idea should be, okay, what does it cost for this particular room? What does it cost for the nurse divided by the amount of people? That's not the way they go about it. So Reagan decides, well, his people, and he went along with it. We don't really need anybody in here for babies for 5 days anymore. So we're going to cut it back to four. That's all, you know, whatever we're paying for or whatever. So they cut it back to four. Guess what? The number didn't change. Because now you had 20% of the rooms were empty. So you had the same cost divided by 20% less nights, and you ended up with the same number. Well, how dumb can we be? Do these people ever go to an accounting class? But it depends on how you look at this stuff. It's sort of crazy, but the question is... do we not have Mr. Flanagan?
Yeah, I'm just fascinated listening to you guys.
Oh, how can you be fascinated listening to me?
I've been fascinated for 50 plus years.
God. Hey, John, I want to thank you on the air. Jen sent me my, there was always somewhat of a family history that I could never actually pin down. And of course, Jen, being the man that he is, managed to pin down my family history, in the sense that he found a a place. By the way, is it school? The church still open, Jen? You found the day my grandmother got married to her first husband, who would have been my great uncle, I guess. And was it 2 months later, he got killed in doing something in the street, holding a cable, and the crane operator touched the high wire. So two guys got sizzled. One of them was this guy, my great uncle. I don't think they got a dime workman's comp or anything. But John found the census stuff. He found the obituary, and he found a write up in the Tribune about two guys getting killed. And thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
It's good stuff. I mean, so what? They were only married 2 months before the guy got smoked.
That's horrible.
Like September to November, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and now that's not good. And so, 5 years later, or 4 years later, she married the younger brother, my grandmother. So the younger brother became my grandfather. But the interesting part is, two families lived kind of in the same address. It was like a two flat, right? Talk about the girl next
building.
Yeah, talk about the girl next door. The girl in the building, for God's sake.
That was very common, too.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And you know, you go back and you look at these places and where people lived. And you look at the weather we had this weekend and how brutal it is, and they talk about, you know, the records we're chasing are from 1953, 1954, which were two were very hot years. You imagine, you know, 8 or 9 people in a 3-bedroom house, no air conditioning, no fans. I'm thinking true love or something. I don't know how they all didn't kill them. Maybe because they didn't have guns, they couldn't kill each other. But you'd think there would have been some. You think there would have been some. More violence between them. I guess that's why the guy went to the bar every night, right?
Yeah. You know, in when I lived in L.A., the 15 years I was there, we had the Santa Ana winds, which the winds would come in, and I don't know which one was the high pressure, low pressure, but the desert air would be coming through very, very, you know, very extreme winds that would come through, and they were just burning hot. In Raymond Chandler, I'm sure most of the listeners know who he was, you know, very famous author, wrote all the detective noir. He made a comment that's when the Santa Anas happened, housewives would, as they sharpened their steak knife, would look at the look in between the shoulder blades of their husbands.
Yeah. What? So, Johnny,
that's the mark of a great writer.
yeah. So,
well, Mr. Flanagan, what do you think of the? I want to go back to the labor numbers and see if you get John's comment on that. What do you think's happening here, John? The Friday numbers were just brutal, which of course causes the market to want to sneak up because it means we're going to lower rates and do that kind of stuff. But when is the rest of the world going to catch up that we can't just keep pouring money into the place and enriching a few people? I mean, That's a tough thing, and yet everybody seems to think it's going on forever. But I don't know that it is. What do you make of this whole mess?
I maybe you can parse this out, or Carl can, or somebody more adept than I am at this. But I'd be interested in an age breakdown, and I'm sure
I think you did that on Friday, but I don't remember. We had to do everything pretty fast.
I'd have to go back and listen again. Recent college graduates, who are exposed to the difficulties of getting a job or a job that they think is adequate to what they want to make and doesn't insult their intelligence by being asked to do things. I just find it, it was tough when we came out in 74.
74 was a brutal year, Jen.
I remember so many places I went to for interviews, just for like entry-level jobs at banks or whatever. Oh, you're much too overqualified. Good luck. You'll get something, I'm sure, but you just wouldn't fit in here. You'd be way over. I was like, overqualified.
I can see you, vice president of auto loans.
But I mean, this was a hell of a thing to say to somebody who thinks now I got student loans, I got a degree, I should be marketable, and I'm being told I'm too qualified.
What year?
74.
So I can remember, Tom, Tom Fenske is the one that got me the job at Pullman. But I remember graduating in 77 with a general business degree, and I mean, the only job you could get was maybe more business forms. It's not a good place to be. And I got a job through a friend's father. It was grim. I mean,
I got stuck with you for 55 years.
Yeah, and you did. I've tried to ruin your life every year since.
Pretty much. Yeah. God. But I'm going to say, Mr. Flanagan, that the only guy who even had an interview and got a job was Bob Gold, because he was a CPA.
I think you're right. Yeah.
I didn't. All the rest of us fled to grad school or law school or someplace.
And those with accounting degrees did. You know, if they didn't get, you know, hired right away, they did get hired, and they did well. You know, they didn't wait years, you know, to find a niche to enter the market. But I just, if I'm trying to, like, compare my experience and your experiences to what's going on now, where, you know, the education has gotten obscenely expensive, and the skills that somebody acquires in most majors, in the liberal arts anyway, aren't likely to enable you to do much of anything that anybody needs to have done.
Now, John, to reference that, I mean, to pile on to that, the difference was you went out and you got a degree in medieval literature, okay? Not the most marketable.
No.
And the difference
I kind of knew what that.
You would graduate with, I don't know, $20,000 or $30,000 of student loans, maybe 40 after 4 years. Now, you're going to graduate with $250,000 of student loan debt.
I don't know of anybody who had student loan debt over a couple of grand.
Yeah. So that's the issue here. I mean, I don't want to just make this a conversation about how messed up things are, but, you know, what universities are charging for education, that's another area that I think needs to kind of be adjusted.
Kind of.
I mean, do students really need to have sushi bars?
Well,
that's a joke. But.
Actually, it isn't a joke because I think what ends up happening in there's a concept in marketing called the wheel of retailing, and it's been around for, you know, God knows how long. But the idea is when somebody puts up a place that's no frills, you know. It's a wine store. They just put the cases on the floor. No racks, no nothing.
Yeah.
They're cheaper than everybody else. All of a sudden, you know, they get a little fat and happy. Hey, we need some racks. We need this. We need that. And all of a sudden, they're inching their prices up. And down the block, somebody says, well, we can just buy the wine and put the cases on the floor and undercut those guys. That's essentially what happens in retail. And you can see it, like, every time. The big box stores, if they get too fat and happy, somebody becomes a dollar store, or somebody becomes something. Well, in college, that's not allowed to happen because of the accreditation and all the other issues. I mean, if you look actually, we talked about it 4th of July. Kathy McGrath, one of Audrey's friends and my friend, she went to Notre Dame after me, and you know, Audrey, of course, came down to one of the reunions with me, or a couple of them, and they were in the dorm rooms. And she's like, what the hell is this? It's an Army cot. And, oh, by the way, I got to go down the hall to take a pee? What kind of deal is this? Bud was not happy. Let's just put it that way. But at the price we paid, it was a bargain, okay?
Yeah.
But now, I think Northwestern, Jimmy, do me a favor, Google this, will you? I'm going to say room and board at Northwestern is 18 grand a year, maybe more.
What is? Room and board?
Yeah. So I'm going to say there's no way on earth you're going down the hall to take a pee, sleeping on an Army cot, and eating chicken and mystery meat every night. You know.
Yeah, so my kids went to, I mean, I'll be honest, they went to Santa Clara University, a wonderful university in Northern California, Santa Clara.
It's Jesuit, right?
Jesuit. Yeah. And, God, the mission is cool, just wonderful. And, but, you know, then that room and board, by the, you know, that room and board is, well, that room and board is $12,000 a year.
That's kind of a lot.
Okay. And, you know, by the time you're done, it's $40,000 a year.
Well, that was,
yeah, actually,
I graduated 5 years ago, right?
Yeah. And that was 5 years ago, yeah. So when I was talking, they were, you know, I made the mistake of giving money once to the university because they did a great job. I mean, I'm very proud of the fact my children went there. And these are money raising machines. Yeah. These universities.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, look, I obviously I'm not going to have a building named after me, but all I want, if I donate, it has to go to kids. It has to help kids do what my daughter did. And, you know, she got a job because she was able to, she's a molecular biologist, because she was able to write a paper. And so then they started to explain, you know, look, this is, you know, could we use the money to buy supplies for kids that are in internships? Or could we use the money to pay for kids that have internships?
I don't want you directing at all where that money goes.
Yeah. And it was really interesting that I said, you know, it has to go to the students. It's not going to anybody's, you know, and I made this up, not going to anybody's private jet, right, for a tenured professor to fly around the world. And I said, that is a joke.
Not much of a joke.
And they said, well, I mean, some of these professors.
Yeah, but once it gets in the general fund, Jen, you don't have no idea. You can't tell where it goes.
No. But anyway, so just my point is that, look, I mean, I'm lucky. I did okay. And I could afford $50,000 a year for a private university. But Jesus Christ, when people go out and take loans out for this, because Lauren has friends that have done that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, it all comes down to...
At $75,000 a year, that $250,000 loan, I don't know about you, John and James... That's a lot of money to pay off.
Okay, but it's one of the major themes of the show, and I would hope that some of the listeners kind of track where I go with this. Whenever you do something like that, it's your view of the world, okay, of the future. When I talk about, you know, if somebody's going to pay, you know, $8 billion for the Bears or some number, and the team's making $180 million a year, or $200 million a year. Okay, what's the, even at 5%, which nobody can really loan, well, maybe if you're 1% or you can get a loan there, your loan payment is going to be $400 million a year. And you say, okay, but I'm only making $200. That, you know, that dog doesn't hunt. In a year, within a year, you're out of business, right? So you must have some sort of a view of the future that, where are we, 2026, that in 2030, the skyboxes, instead of being, you know, 20 grand a game, we're going to be 60 grand a game or something. And then the tickets, instead of being 150 bucks, are going to be 500 bucks. You need some view of the world that better work out for you if you take that chance, right? Now, students, if you went back even 10 or 15 years, when all this stuff started to happen with these college tuitions and people started getting out these loans, if you were to look and see what a graduate was making, Even out of the engineering school, some, you know, the school that everybody wants to go to, the starting price was probably 65, 60, somewhere in there. But their view of the world is, hey, in 10 years, we're talking, you know, 160 or 200 or 250. So this loan is going to be a pimp on the ass of an elephant in 10 years. Well, guess what? That didn't happen. Prices are way up, but salaries are not. So what happened was people's view of what is going forward screwed up. A terrific example of that, and again, it sounds like I'm skipping around, but I'm not. A perfect example of that is when the Cubs signed Soriano. This is back, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. They signed him for $8 million a year or some huge number, just when these salaries were marching up. And they thought, okay, it's an eight-year deal or something. Well, 5 years from now, an average outfielder is going to be $8 million, or he's going to be more than that. So we're actually getting a deal with this guy, even though we're paying up this year. In 8 years, this is going to be a steal. And the and guess what? Over a period of time, it was kind of a mini recession. There was one time when baseball the ticket prices didn't race up, the values didn't race up. And all of a sudden, even though the guy played very well for the Cubs, everybody bitched at him because now you could get an average outfielder or an above-average outfielder for $4 million. But I will say the absolute best example, and you guys remember this because you're not kids, was Magic Johnson. Magic Johnson was signed to a $1 million a year, 25-year deal with L.A. Lakers, when $1 million was a huge amount of money.
A lot of money, yeah.
And everybody looked at that and goes, oh, my God, how could somebody sign for that? There was so much inflation during that period of time. When was his first year? I don't remember.
Oh, God. The inflation back then was, because Volcker.
Yeah.
So Magic Johnson signed when, in 82?
Somewhere
81,
like
82, something like that. And I can remember seeing Pat Riley give a speech, and that was in 84, and Magic had been in, I think, for 2 years. But the inflation rate back then had to, I think it was 8-9%.
Well, it was 12.
Yeah.
But it couldn't have been 3 years in, and he wasn't even the highest paid guy in his team or something. I mean, it was unbelievable that there's no way you could hold that guy to that contract, although the Bulls did to Scottie Pippen, because Reinsdorf's a bigger bleep. But it was an embarrassment. It had nothing to do. If your vision going forward, God, if you paid $8 billion for the Bears, and we go into recession in 10 years from now, the price are the same as they are today. Boy, where are you? you're in deep doo-doo, wouldn't you say?
Right.
Well, Chief, your answer is $18,790 is what is cost for room and board.
Is what?
$18,790 is room and board at Northwestern.
That's a number. You better be eating high every night.
And it costs
$80,000?
Yeah.
$80,000 a year. Now, to give you gentlemen an idea, my father, back in 1970, told a lot of his colleagues that by the time I went to college, which was in the mid-80s, that the college tuition private school would be $20,000 to $25,000. They all laughed at him. They ain't laughing now.
Well, look at the amount of money that Kevin's place at Ivy Tech, how much they can deliver a really good class to somebody for per student. And I'll bet it's, well, I don't know. I mean, I know that when I went to the University of Chicago, my 2 years, you know, I cheated a little bit because I went in the summer, which I gave you a bargain to do, but I'm going to say my 2 years was a total of $6,000. Now, one class, I think, is $6,500. You got to take 20 classes. Now, does anybody think that the... So what is that? I paid... what's 20 goes into? I paid $300 a class, and now it's $6,500. So that's... What the hell is that? It's 30 times? 35 times? Does anybody think that the professors are making 35 times more than they did in 1976? I don't think so. So where are all these costs? What are they doing? Where's all the dough? The University of California, last time I looked, this is the, you know, Berkeley's and there's like 9 of those, Mr. Flanagan or Jan? It's,
yeah. There used to be a, you know, great system.
Well, no, it still is a great system.
Yeah.
And come on, I mean, Berkeley, UCSF are stunning research institutions.
So what?
Yeah, but I think they're less accessible to Californians than they ever were. You know, they have catered to international students like everybody else because pay for freight.
My kids live out there, and my daughter is, you know, is looking at those places, and those are, you know, they've always had international students there, and I mean, to say that they're less institutions, I think, is a misnomer.
Well, I didn't say that. What I said is they have 10 indirect employees for every professor. What the bleep is that all about?
What's the what?
Yep.
They have 10 indirect employees for every professor.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, fair enough. But as research institutions, they are.
But who cares?
Yeah.
To be honest with you. I mean, I know it's an ignorant statement, but... Who gives a crap? But who gives a crap? If I'm going there to learn business, why do I have to fund a research student? So a medical school, if they find something, they sell it to some big company and they make all the money. Why do I have to pay for that?
You know, it's one thing when universities have decided, you know, in order to attract the kind of students we want, we're going to have, you know, a food court that rivals any shopping mall, and, you know, dorm space that, you know, where you're almost embarrassed to live in because it's so opulent. But not only that, they have to attract top-line faculty to be magnets for whatever programs they want to highlight. And what's happened to places like UIC and other places too, yeah, you can hire some star faculty, but you're also going to have to, you know, hire that star faculty's spouse, because they're not going to come to whatever town you're in unless you let them bring the spouse with them, and also be, you know, an endowed faculty member, you know, like everybody else that they're trying to appeal to. So you just double the cost of getting a big name professor, because it's going to be a package deal or no deal at all. So you start totaling that up across a curriculum, and you get into the medical field, you know, all the expenses of just having a medical school, let alone a hospital attached to the university, and everybody gets, you know, huge bills to support that, and how much of it really translates to a student's experience, let alone the quality of the student's education. It's all being just, you know, funneled around to attract people at the front end of the building, and you don't care what you turn out at the exit. So,
well, I mean, when you talk about this, is, you know, this is actually a serious economic question. When you show up and you're eating, you know, by the way, we always ate well, so it wasn't like you died from the place. Ate three meals a day, they were pretty damn good. How do you go from the army cots and the down the hall bathroom, which comes first? If somebody was given that option at Notre Dame today and said, okay, you can live in one of the new opulent dorms and eat in the place with the, you know, the spinning Sunday desserts and the Mexican thing and the salad bar, you can do that for 15 grand or for 5 grand. You could go the way we went. How many people would pick the 5 grand? I think a lot. But my question is, and this is an economic, this isn't my question, it's an economic question. At $1,000, the dorm we stayed in seemed fine. Okay, now I'm talking about inflation. But if you start charging 10, and you go, wait a minute, you got four guys in a room this big, you can't charge 10. In other words, which comes first? You start charging so much to where people look at it and go, what the hell is this all about? How could you be eating eat chicken every night and you're paying the equivalent of $100 a meal? Which comes first? I mean, I don't, economically, that's a question that's been around for the centuries. Are people demanding the better stuff because you're charging them more, or are you charging them more because they demanded the stuff in the first place? I think you're charging them more, and people say, "I'm not paying for this," but I don't know. That's one person's opinion. What do you think?
I think, you know, they're charging more because their expenses across the board are just, you know, growing at an astronomical rate. And then when people begin to see, well, you're not putting any of this money back into the living space for my little Susie or Johnny or whatever, you better start doing that, or I'm not going to give you a second look. So they decided, well, now we got to, you know, really explode the spending on the amenities side of it to, you know, give ourselves a recruiting edge. It's the same thing in sports too. I mean, this is kind of the parallel things. The academic corruption and the sports corruption are hand in hand here. But I just, you know,
I Ann Arbor, and I got to tell you, sports corruption, that's a sore spot with me. Not to interrupt you, John, here, but
go ahead.
The small businessman in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Tom's heard me say this many times. After being around those football programs and being hit up, it forget it. I mean, I know that is
probably... They always wanted your own man to pony up cars for, like, the assistant coaches and stuff?
Oh, yeah. It was just bullshit. Sorry for my phrase. But no, the college athletics... Now, this is 1970s, so it was bad then. You know, it's probably just as bad now. Anyways, I got to get going here, but I want to leave one... I want to change the subject for 1 second and talk about something, if you guys don't mind.
Sure.
I read a book this weekend called The Long Way Home. And I think we all know about those real famous airplanes. They call the Clippers.
Yep.
The biggest airplanes, I think, in the world of the day. They landed on the ocean. And it was Pan Am. And on there was a flight from L.A. to Hawaii down to the Southern Pacific Islands and then to New Zealand. And, of course, it went off on December 4th. So they're flying down, and guess what happens? 1941. So guess what happens? And they're flying in from the South Pacific down to New Zealand, and they get Pearl Harbor was attacked.
Recording stopped.
And they had already given the captain instructions on what to do. And so he had to get home, but since he was down in New Zealand, they got home, took 6 weeks. New Zealand, Darwin, Australia, Indonesia, Karachi, Bahrain, Khartoum. The best one is the capital of the Congo now, Leopoldville. They had to land in the Congo River. This boat, Brazil, Venezuela, and New York City. Now that was a trip. That was the wildest story I've read.
Did you know, boy, talk about some of the stupid stuff you read and remember, you know that no river has a current like the Congo River?
Now that was the part that was in a 6-knot current.
Yeah.
You were trying to take off. Do you follow the current down, or do you go upriver? I mean, it was harrowing. That was the worst. That was the most dangerous. So, anyways, I know that's rare.
You know, nobody, even fish, can't swim across. Each side of the river has their own species. The river is so fast that the animals can't even you can't swim across a thing to mate.
Yeah. So, anyways, it was such a wild story. Just imagine doing that in 1940.
Well, they were made of...
Thanks for bringing that up. I'm just looking it up online. Ed Dover is the author.
He's the author. I mean, it's not well written, but it's just like, what?
It's a hell of a story.
It actually, if any story deserves to be made into a movie or a novel, it's that. But it was just, you know, think about it. They did have some problems. They were trying to get into Indonesia, and they were flying. Those planes actually flew pretty low.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're props. And they got those huge things on the bottom of them.
He ran across a submarine with a rising sun on it, and you know, they had to get in the clouds very fast. They were almost shot down in Indonesia by the Dutch, because the Dutch didn't know what they were. But anyways, look, I'm going to get going here. I know I just changed the subject, but I just...
That's all right. We do that all the time.
Thanks, John.
And for all your listeners, try that one on. It's not a well-written book, but it's quite a story.
Well, all this, I mean, I don't know, Mr. Flanagan, John Lee left, but you read, like, the Winds of War, where was Pug Henry was in Berlin, and he got the thing that he was going to go command the California and Hawaii. And how do you get from Berlin to Hawaii in 1941? He ended up taking the Trans-Siberian Express across, and he picked up the Clipper in Hong Kong or someplace. And then the Clipper got him to Hawaii. And he got there after Pearl Harbor, so the California was on the bottom of the harbor, so that didn't help him out much. So it took forever to fix that thing. They ended up getting it back together for use in a couple of years. They ended up getting... There's only a couple of the battleships that went down that they weren't able to fix. Those are really... That's fascinating stories, by the way, and how they refloated those ships and got them over to dry dock, and virtually all of them to California, and I'm going to say, I can't name the rest of them, but there were like four or five that actually lived to sail again, and they used them for bombardment and stuff, because they were all pretty much old battleships. But the amount of work they did on those things to bring them back to being, you know, serviceable is really an American story, and how many people got on those ships and the cleaning, and some of them, you know, between the bodies and all the other stuff that are in the damn things. I mean, it was just totally disgusting, but it's really an American, you know, story that only, you know, it's one of the reasons why we celebrate our 250th, right? I mean, nobody, yep, nobody ever dreamed that those things could be used again, but they all were. And they weren't used for, they weren't fast enough to be chasing the carriers or anything. But they were plenty good enough for shore bombardments and those kinds of things. So, you know, just fascinating stuff that we're able to do here. You know, here's one, John, I keep forgetting to Say, but talk about things what people used to be able to do in this country. I mean, we still do fantastic stuff. Don't get me wrong. But after the Civil War, one of the biggest problems in reuniting the country were, and everybody's going, what the hell is he talking about? Well, the train gauge, how wide the rails are on trains, is obviously pretty important, right? They all got to be the same width, or you're not going to get too far. And they weren't back in those days. The North had roughly all of the railroads in the North had 4 feet 8.5 inches, and the South was five feet. And the guy who made the decision as to what the gauge was going to be going forward, which, by the way, was the wrong decision looking backward, was Abraham Lincoln, because the railroad that was going to go, the Transcontinental Railroad, was going to be the gauge that we use going forward. So he picked 4 8.5 going west. Okay, so that became the gauge. And after the Civil War, trying to reunite the North and the South, but the obviously the gauges were different. And so they said, okay, we got to change the gauges in the South from 5 feet to 4 feet 8.5. So you had to move them over, you know, whatever that is, 3.5 inches, right?
Yeah.
So, you know how long it took to do that? I don't know. Just
6 months.
One weekend.
Oh,
one
better.
Weekend. They absolutely. I'm not talking about every you know one of the rail yards and all that kind of stuff, but every one of the main lines, it happened in one weekend. They staged everything. All the nut, you know, the spikes and all that stuff, and people, they just had everybody logistically put together, and they went mile after mile after mile, pull it up, move it over, hammer it. It took looked like 3 or 4 days, and they redid almost the entire system in that length of time. And now today, what does it take us to repave a street, for God's sake? You know, I mean, somehow or another, we got to get our mojo back here, and I don't know how we go about doing that. And there's all kinds of conflicting, you know, arguments back and forth, and people are blaming other people and all this other kind of stuff. But the fact is, you know, we're killing people with these student loans. And somewhere between what Kevin's school does for people and how much it costs them to pony up an accounting class, and Notre Dame or Michigan or somebody else charging, you know, 30 times that, for God knows what, you know, is these are big decisions we have to make going forward, because you can't have the people that are working making, you know, half of what they thought they were going to make when they went to school. I'm talking about people that are 30, 32 years old that I run into that are making, you know, 60 grand a year, which doesn't sound horrible. It's, you know, it's way above the median, but they're living in Chicago or New York or someplace with huge expenses, and they've got a, you know, $100,000 loan. They're never going to be able to afford a car, a house. God help you, they're never going to get married, they're never going to have any kids. You know, hopefully they got a girlfriend at least. But I mean, these are these kinds of problems. That's why, you know, economics is really a social science. It's not numbers. And the stuff that Hal does, that's a branch of economics that once you get into it, that obviously is very important. But economics is a social science. How do we apportion what we have in a way where most people, I won't say benefit, where you hand it to them, most people can at least contribute and do something and at least get paid what they contribute. And we're way off on that. I mean, we're way off on that. And I think the mentality, I mean, I'm not, the only piece of genius that I have, John, is that I took a bunch of economics classes, I enjoyed them, I went to class, and I remember what the guy said. That's my only genius. So that's not a being a genius, is it? I mean, it's not like I wrote a book or anything. But I remember what people said. And I know, you know, I had a class in labor economics and how much people are supposed to get paid. I don't see any stretch now of that being what's accurate. You're supposed to get paid somewhat to what you're contributing to people. Do you see any of that?
No. And there's no formula that, you know, institutions would tolerate or, you know, sign on to make that happen. And I don't even know what it would look like. I mean, I just think that the total detachment of just speaking of education from the value of that particular course somebody's taking, and then you look at what's been expended on it by the institution that's employed, you know, a faculty member, maybe a very high-end one too, and then you spread that out over how many students that person is teaching, the return on this investment, I think for the average student, is like pretty hard to figure out. It may just be because it's so minuscule. I don't know what they're actually expecting students to take away from a lot of the stuff that they're teaching them.
Well,
it's hard to say.
John, you and I think at the price we paid, and again, I'm always going to zero in on same way when I pick stocks. What am I paying? What am I getting? I mean, it's still the same old story, right? What am I paying? What am I getting? And the price we paid to spend 4 years learning to deal with other people, learning some stuff because we all went to class pretty much. Whatever you were in, I don't think it was a waste to learn English, to learn history, to learn anything, because you took other classes, you took some math, you took some science. You learn some stuff. I don't see how that ever, at that price, wasn't worth it to you. Now, at 80 grand a year, if you're going to lollygag your way through college, you come out with a massive debt. To me, the price is wrong, not the idea. Now, but how do you? And I was being a little rude to Jen Lee about this spread between. I'm going to go to. Have an economics degree at Notre Dame. Now, the thing that was nice about Notre Dame was I was able to sneak into the business school. I took a full year accounting. I took marketing. I took taxation. I took finance. I pretty much, for lack of a better, even though they won't tell me I did, I pretty much got a business degree too, right? So, but if you go to like Illinois, from what I understand now, And you get in because you didn't have the English or arts and letters, if even that's what they call it. You can't go take an accounting course because right. They're full. Well, that to me, that blows big time.
So and it's more likely too. You'll have to spend a fifth year there, even if you're an English major.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't want to. But that's totally different from my experience. But now. You know, John Lee mentioned, well, these are great research institutions. Okay, I'm going to learn economics. I got five professors. How many people in class? How much do they make? What does it cost to run the classroom? What's the number here? You can't, quintuple my number to finance the research institution. What's that got to do with me? I mean, there's some reputation that you like to have that happen, and maybe your professors are better if, by the way, they're doing a little research as well and so forth. So I guess I'm willing to pay up a little for that, but how much? I mean, am I going to pay 80 grand a year if you look at my professors and the classes and the amount of people in class, that my cost is 10? Where's the other 70? What's going for research? Well, I don't get any money out of the research. So if I did, all right, now suppose we all did pay 80, and again, this is me, it's like I'm pricing a stock. Okay, you want me to contribute 70 grand for, quote, research. Okay, so I'm paying this one asshole to write a book, and oh, by the way, I'm paying these other people to do research on, small cell something. Yeah. Okay, well, suppose they make a breakthrough in small cell something or something. Well, now, did I just buy stock in that? Am I going to participate in that? Or is Eli Lilly going to come in and snatch it, get a patent on it, and make a gazillion dollars, and the people who donated directly or indirectly to all this research don't get squat? Well, that's not a good deal, is it?
No.
I mean...
But, it's like the universities have decided, and they're the parents are kind of feeding into it too, that if you get a degree in whatever field from this well-known research institution that you should be very proud to attend, that they're giving you some aura surrounding your diploma when you leave. that this is going to translate to, well, yeah, you learned a lot in class A, B, C, or D, but look at the institution you came from. And that just got neon lights written around it because of its, you know, prominence in, you know, medical research or, you know, engineering research, whatever. And these are things that don't affect you at all with your degree in some completely remote subset of academic life. But this is, it's like you should feel, you know, greatly enhanced by having a degree from us. And I'm afraid that people have really bought into this too, because this is why they pay so much attention at the selection stage. Where is my kid going to go? Is it going to be a happy time? Because, you know, I'll scrimp and save and go into debt to make sure that they've got a leg up in the job market. And if they have a degree from this place, this should translate in some HR department to giving this person priority over, you know, so many other institutions. And that's been, you know, a dream that people are chasing. And people overseas, of course, have bought into it too.
Yeah, but John, it's not just a dream. Why do you say it's just a dream? It's actually fact.
But that's at some point, does it really give you that much advantage over some other candidate in the job market? I don't know.
I guess the question is how much?
Or was it worth it?
Well, to your credit or discredit, depending on what mood anybody's in today, you're an attorney. All right, so I think what happens in HR departments, we have a little bit of this ourselves. If you graduated Notre Dame, people think that you're somehow more advanced than somebody who graduated God knows where, right? You and I know that could very well not be the case. I mean, right?
But a lot of people hate Notre Dame.
Well, in terms of that, yeah. But
I'm saying it doesn't always count in your favor if you are lucky enough to go to a job, you know, that where there's an ND graduate there who has something to say about it and wants to extend an invitation to a fellow grad. You know, that's certainly helped me, I think, in a lot of cases.
I'm not
downplaying that.
But Notre Dame, Illinois forever. Let's just pick a spot. Let's say the accounting department. Notre Dame, Illinois, Indiana are known to have terrific accounting graduates, right? They, virtually everybody passes their CPA. They learn something when they're there. It's, you know, the HR departments essentially fall back and rely on the school's selection process, right? I mean, if you're going to come out of Purdue with an engineering degree, guess what? Pretty friggin' hard to get into Purdue and go 4 years of education. I mean, my cousin came out of Ohio State in aerospace engineering. Well, they were considered to have one of the best schools. It's a 5-year major. If you come out of there with a B+ average, not only were you pretty smart to get there, you pretty much got your ass kicked for 5 years, and you came out of there, you know something. So you're definitely you're paying for that, which doesn't mean to say that you can't get some guy from Montana State that's smarter than a guy that came out of Ohio State, but you should know this in law firms. If you got a big firm and you hire some guy from Harvard or Yale and you dump him on if ever you had any issues with law people, they come in with an entourage of 4 or 5 people. Now you don't need all these idiots. The fact is, they come in with an entourage to run your bill up in most cases. Well, the last guy on the bench, you're paying $300 an hour for that guy, or $400. Well, if he's from Harvard, they can get away with it. If he was from John Marshall when he graduated last week, you go, wait a minute, what am I paying $4 an hour for that guy for? I mean, the aura that comes out, you're paying for the Harvard selection process, correct?
Supposedly, which, yeah. I'm saying that may account for a lot in certain, you know, well-publicized and, you know, well-earned, respected, you know, programs like aerospace or whatever, because there's not that many of them around or universities that can support them. So it's pretty easy to pick out the ones that graduate outstanding people. But there's a lot of outstanding universities in that regard that have run-of-the-mill degrees in things that are totally useless for getting a job. But because you got it from that institution, it's been sort of, you know, advertised that this is going to be worth its while to you, even if you didn't learn that much, or even if it's not a department that we particularly respect on this campus. but we're still going to charge you for a top flight degree, and you should be very glad you got it from us. And you know, just wait for all the job offers to come in. This is kind of how it's been pitched.
Oh yeah, well, there's no doubt. Well, I mean,
they're running on empty now. But I think a lot of these, you know, certainly a lot of these disciplines that don't earn their keep, just in terms of what they can actually enable you to do when you graduate, it doesn't translate to a high-paying job. It maybe doesn't translate to a job at all.
Well, no, but it should be worth it on its own, and at some price it is.
Right, right. And if things were cheaper and you could, you know, take time off to, you know, burnish the things you started to learn in college and still survive and have a crack at, you know, getting a job advancement along the way. But you're going to just waste your entire life and be 50 years old trying to figure out what you want to do with it.
Well, I mean, a lot of people change gears, and that's why whatever you're taking, you should cross over a little bit and take something else, because you never right. know where you're liable to land. But I think the issue comes down to, you know, right now people are, you know, there's this aura, like you say, and I think the aura is overvalued is really what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But right now, somebody from, I mean, the two people that are the best at this on the show are Russell and Kevin. I mean, when Kevin, his school, Ivy Tech, punches people. They do a lot of stuff, different, you know, different blue collar things and stuff. But by and large, if you want to go take a business degree, you can take the first 2 years at Ivy Tech, and you can shift over to Indiana, where Russell's happy to grab you, right? Because he teaches in Indiana, or you can go to Purdue, out of Ivy Tech, pretty easily. Well, now guess what? You're graduating with the Purdue or Indiana degree, which is much more in today's world, again, not whether it's right or wrong, much more prestigious than if Ivy Tech just added two more years. Well, you know, should it be? I don't know. But I guess what they're saying is you learned enough at Ivy Tech to where you fit in Indiana, and now you're graduating from a really serious business school, and by the way, nobody cares where you went your first 2 years.
And you saved a lot of tuition.
You saved a lot of tuition. So, I mean, so we're seeing people kind of splitting the baby in half, right? Plus, what's worse than coming out of college with $200,000 in debt is coming out of 2 years not graduating with $100,000 in debt. that's even worse, right? So at least at the end of 2 years, you know that's what you want to do. And at worst, you know, you got 2 years of debt versus one. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways to do this, but you ask yourself, why? Why doesn't, I mean, you've got, what's this place south of the Loop, IIT? It's still there, right? They're still doing something.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Okay, why doesn't, I don't know of anybody here in Chicago, honestly. I know some guys in the SIBO would go over and teach their finance and so forth. I don't know anybody here, and UIC has turned into a pretty nice place. I mean, in fact, they're pretty highly rated. How many people sit there and go, I'm just going to go get a business degree at UIC, I'm going to live at home and blah blah blah, and I'm gonna cut this $80,000 a year down to 10, you know, type of thing. But if you go to UAC and you commute, what are they charging you? I mean, how many people in class? Is it 30 people in class? How much is it per class? Is it $1,000? Okay, well that's $30,000. How much are you paying that prof for that class? You're not paying them $10,000, are you? Or 20? Maybe you are. Where is all this? Where is the overhead? Who's getting the money? How much are you paying the chairman? These are all questions that, you know, I love to dig into. And that's really where, that's why, to turn it back to the political discussion, when the socialists say, whatever they are, even though they don't think they're socialists, we're just going to have the government pay for the health care. Well, if you don't change anything, what good does that do? It just adds another layer, doesn't it?
Yeah. Then you start giving them free college tuition, Tom.
Well, I mean, question is, at what point does it become included? I mean,
I just looked up UIC's tuition, by the way. $16,500 per year for in-state, and $33,200 for out-of-state.
Isn't that ridiculous? The difference.
And that's, of course, it doesn't include any room and board.
Right.
They now are, you know, they used to be a commuter institution like DePaul was, and they tried to branch out and become a residential school. So that's, you know, you're up to 50 plus thousand if you want to live on campus.
Yeah.
So. That's not much of a bargain anymore.
The S&P futures up 29, NASDAQ futures up 338. We'll come back. We'll talk a little about that. Plus, we'll have Audrey talking about real estate. And Jen, there's another couple places downtown here that look like they're in the crapo, huh? I mean, it's like one every week. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
So you're going to make a lot of money, right?
We're back.
Hello, North Bank Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al, Jim Lawler on the board. Illinois 250, meet the state's most influential people, from architects to a pope and future presidents. Let's see. Lawler. I don't see that on here. Flanagan. Uh-huh. No. O'Neill. Kevin O'Neill. I don't see any of us on here. What the hell? We got to protest this.
We got to
protest this list. This can't be a very good list if we're not on it, for God's sake. You think somebody would be on there? Lou Michaels. No, he can say he's not from Illinois anymore. We're not doing so hot here. I mean, amazing. So S&P futures up 31. NASDAQ futures up 349. We've got the Dow futures actually down 58. Why is that? Caterpillar is up 37. Got Honeywell down 5. Honeywell's back in the Dow. I mean, see, Google is now in the Dow, which is interesting. We have Salesforce down $1.50, Procter & Gamble down $1.25. We got Verizon down $2.49. It's been up a bunch lately. So that's where that all is. Over in Asia, we have our crazy stocks. Tesla's up 5. As soon as they won that court case, they've been going up pretty fast. Meta. All the ones that were down in the 7 are now up, and the other ones are heading back the other way. Let's see if Micron's doing anything today. It's up 33. It was getting clobbered last week. It traded 1,200. It's down to 1,008. With Nikkei down 6, call that flat. Hang Seng up 266. That's a whole full 1%. Shanghai over down 2. That's kind of weird. Over in Europe, with the DAX down 5, call that flat. FTSE down 32.3%. CAC around. You would think the FTSE would have celebrated their victory. CAC around down 6.1%. Bonds down 0.2, but the 10-year is 4.46. Still right around at 4.5, which seems to be the one that everybody's worried about. Oil down 45 cents, 68.24. RBOB is actually up 4 cents, 295. So everybody knows where that puts yourself tax-wise, where that puts your gas. For some reason, we were up. I mean, we up in Homer Glen was up like 30 cents last week. Not sure where that was. Gold up 34 hours, 41.59. Gold's having a little bit of a bounce here. Silver buck 38, 62.44. We got foreign exchange, which has been the big yen pin near 40-year lows, 162.33. I think we're going to see some selling of U.S. Bonds and bills from the Japanese government to try and prop that back up. We will see. Crypto down 670 and a Bitcoin 62,067, but back up over 60,000, which seems to be the real spot that everybody's worried about. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, soccer, Cubs. We got all kinds of stuff.
Yes, we do, Chief. The inbound Kennedy right now is at 11 minutes. The inbound Edens is at 24. The inbound Eisenhower is at 19. And the inbound Dan Ryan is at 16. In weather, Chicago, it's going to be nice. High of 77, and we're currently at 71. In Phoenix, it's 88, and the high will be 113. In sports, yes, Cubs win, Sox win. Great matches yesterday. Brazil lost, and they are out. They are out of the tournament.
Yeah.
And England won and held on after going down 10 men for a whole half. And 11 minutes in overtime. Back to you.
That was pretty interesting. A lot of what's happening. Tonight's gonna be a pretty heavily watched game. It's 7 o'clock, right, Jimmy? Or is it 6?
It is at 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. Okay, and it's in Seattle.
Yes, it is.
Now they've had several games there, right?
Yes, Seattle has had several games.
And so is SoFi. I know a couple of them are in New York, but is there anybody? Oh, there was a couple in Dallas. Is there anybody else?
Houston had one in Kansas City.
Okay.
And Miami has them.
Okay. Well, boy, the weather in Philadelphia was, what, 98?
It was a hot one.
Do we have Audrey?
We do.
Yes, you do.
Hey, Aud, how are you?
I'm fine. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Audrey.
We've been all over the block here on how to price. Actually, we're not over the block. It's how to price ball players, how to price stocks, how to price universities. It's kind of all the same subject, isn't it? It's how to price houses, right? Same thing.
It's all about the money.
all about the Benjamins, as they say. So the mortgage rates have been very steady. What are they? They're mid-sixes or something? And the 10-year rate's been 4.3 to 4.5 now for a long time. Some people are still dreaming of 3%. I don't think that's going to happen, but I hope it doesn't go to 8 either. So what's the mood in the industry?
You know, it's been busier. People are, actually, it's kind of interesting. The mortgage activity has actually ticked up in the last week or two. And it comes down to people simply realizing that this is going to be your new normal. And if you want to buy a house, you're going to have to pay the current rate. It's like anything else. You become used to it. This is what it's going to be. There's no way around it unless you have a rich uncle that wrote you in the will. So you'd buy it. But homes actually in the area that our MLS have actually ticked up like 7.1% in the last few months. So we've seen actually a rise. Chicago itself has popped up a little bit. But, again, we've seen another rise in prices here. So that, but interest rates had actually ticked down a hair last week. So there was I see the mortgage statistics pop up a little bit. I'm sure Nancy will be able to fill you in on more of that next week. But now we're also entering the summer doldrums. It's not, July and August used to be when everybody had to go out and buy a house so the kids could be in school. But since household formations changed, the world has changed, July and August are a lot of times the very quietest time of the year. You'll see people are on vacation. Schools go back so early now. I mean, some kids are, used to be you went back to school after Labor Day or right around there. And you've got kids going back by mid-August, and the kids that are in sports a lot of times have to be back there at the beginning of August, or if you're in a certain specialized program at a college, you have to report early. So families have July, part of June, to spend together, and they take it. So if they're in the house hunting, a lot of times if it's not their priority, it's on the back burner, and we see a little slowdown in activity now.
If somebody were to give anybody a test in an economic school and you say in 3 years your interest rates are going to go from 3 to 6, what happens to home prices? Not very many people would say they would be up. Not saying they shouldn't be, it's just it's not something
well,
you would necessarily
you factor in all the other elements, as you know, Mr.
Yeah, Economics. Well, I don't, but I'm saying that I guess that's a pretty serious inflation on that. Because the actual cost to carry the house has got to be up how much, right? if you take the increase in housing.
It's practically a doubling. I mean, you're going 3 to 6.5, but you're not at 7.5. No. So that's the good thing. And it just is what it is for now. There's nothing you could do about it. You know, if you want a house, it's still cheaper than trying to rent something. The rental market is very difficult for people.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, there's not in the repair market, unless you're really good at it, you don't really want to buy a place and then have to put $100,000 into the place, because where are you going to get that money? I mean,
that's what our parents used to do. They would take on one project at a time.
Yeah.
Maybe you moved in and you needed a roof or you needed some windows, and then they saved up for a while, and then they did all the important stuff. That's how my grandparents were. You didn't worry about it being pretty. You worried that the roof didn't leak and the furnace worked. And then you moved on to, remodeling the kitchen or a bathroom. So it's a different mentality, and it's not people who grew up with HGTV think everything could be perfect right away. And unless you're one of those lucky people that have a lot of money to do what they want, it still can't happen for most people.
Well, you've managed in the last couple of years, being a stager in real estate, you always had a pretty good idea, but now that you've actually done some remodeling, I think you're somewhat astounded, even with having good people and knowing where the stuff to buy and that kind of thing, at how much it actually costs and how much, if you don't know what you're doing, how much you get stuck by people.
Oh, my God, yes. That even, when you think you know everything and then you find out that you don't, it's always a shock. But it's true. I mean, labor is expensive. Materials are expensive. And you have to shop around. It's still expensive even if you get a bargain. It's not what it was 5 years ago. Certainly not what it was 6 to 10 years ago. But what is? But I had a thought. What John thought about this. And I'm sure you guys remember back in the recession when buildings were, condo buildings, townhomes, developments were offering rent-to-own options for people. And it seems that maybe now that somebody could go back to, the states could have a program where they have these empty buildings. Well, maybe turn them into a condo with a rent-to-option buy. You know, somebody comes in and qualified people, but take that percentage, what individuals used to do even, and I think you will remember this, they would say, okay, we'll hold your mortgage at that time. We'll give you a balloon in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, and maybe 30% is going to be 40%. Whatever you negotiated would go towards being your down payment on that property. And it might be an answer for lower income people to get into something. Again, you have to qualify. Can't be given things to people that can't pay for them, because it's a recipe for disaster. But somebody who is qualified but can't get the down payment together, rent it to them with a certain amount of years, but if you don't execute it, then it goes away. Someplace, open a door for somebody at a reasonable savers rate.
Well, I would say that's actually, now what are you doing with an idea like that? You're thinking out of the box, and it actually makes some sense. Why would anybody do that?
Well, the contract sales, like you're describing, Audrey, were the places and the times when you would see them most in evidence was when you had a desperate seller and a desperate buyer.
Correct.
Because and of course this was hand in hand with redlining in urban centers like Chicago, where if you were African American, you were not welcome at an institutional lender. So you would, not have a standard mortgage, commitment when you walked into a viewing of a house. So instead, you would, the seller was probably trying to sell the house in a neighborhood that was changing and wanted to get out and was going to take a loss on it anyway. Maybe would be happy to say, okay, here's an agreement for a deed, in 3 years, you go get a mortgage because now you got equity and you're a better credit risk, and then we can wait for our money and then we'll have another closing a couple of years from now. And that was very, very common, and not just in changing neighborhoods, but
I remember that being very popular during the recession.
That
it was a buyer's market, and they were offering incentives like do this for 6 months or a year, you know, we'll float you, we'll help, whatever.
Right.
Well, I don't know if we were listening to the first part of the show. Jan and I were talking about some of the kids that have, you know, the degrees that are 30, 32 years old that are paying off these student loans. Well, there's no way they're saving up for a down payment. But the day they're done with their student loans, they now have some extra money where they could build some stuff up. They'd be a perfect candidate for what you're talking about. Rent for a while, build up some stuff, and then buy 2 years from now. At least get you in the. I mean, that's a perfect solution to what we were talking about early. The minute you're done with your credit card, okay, now I'm making enough where I have some extra stuff I could start saving. That would be the perfect time to do what you're talking about, wouldn't it, Jen?
Yeah, and of course. What it needs, you know, for it to work, is you have to have, you know, I think a job market that's a little more stable and encouraging than the one we're in, because, you know, if you sign a contract that, you know, I'm going to, you know, pay you X amount towards my building up my equity in this house, it assumes I have a job that's going to continue to pay pretty much that amount and I can afford it. And if that, you know, goes off the rails somehow, you're just as big a trouble. You may lose your entire investment then too.
But so I think what I'm looking at, the more stable person, that even if it's not out of college, maybe you're in your mid-20s, whatever, where you've already, this is a perfect example. One of my best friend's nieces is graduated nursing school, and of course she's young, she wants to live downtown. Well, we all know what the price of an apartment is downtown. And instead of her renting a one bedroom for $2,500, $3,000 a month, what if she could get into a program like that? You know, and then she buys it, and then and she's accumulating it equity. She still retains the right that if she wants to at any time sell, in case things go bad, you could sell it, so you're not going to be bound where you lose everything. I think that if it's a solution for some buildings that are struggling, areas that
yes.
are struggling.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, developments that never really took off the way.
All right, guys, somebody's got to explain how these.
And it doesn't even have to be for people that are borderline. It could be people who are would normally be considered middle class, but can't save that down payment because it's always going somewhere.
All right, guys, you got to.
It's a forced savings account in a way.
All right, educate the listeners and educate me. What does this contract actually read? If is it just a regular rental contract with the right of first refusal?
The official title was always Articles of Agreement for Warranty Deed, and the idea was that you had a personal property interest. You didn't own anything during the term of this contract, but of course the seller knew you had amassed equity in, as your payments accumulated every month, and the contract would be written in such a way that when you achieve this threshold amount that's been negotiated, we will be in a position to give you a warranty deed once you come up with the balance of this agreed upon sales price.
Is the price
so
fixed going in?
The sales price for a number of years, for one thing.
Is the price fixed going in?
Price jumping up or down, and then you had to go out and get, you know, standard financing. But you were in a much better position to do that if you already had an equity position, and you would have to prove how much you had actually paid, and you get a letter from the seller right. saying how much had been performed on the contract.
Right,
but then your lenders were more willing to give you a mortgage because you were now, you know, negotiating something as if you already had the down payment paid.
Right. Going into the detail. The rental price is two grand a month. I'm going to pay $2,500, and I'm going to get this deal. So at the end of 2 years, I've now got 500 times 24 months, which is 12 grand stored up. Where is it stored up? Is it an escrow
No, it's just money that the, you know, the seller is using. It's just, you know, they're crediting you with it.
Okay, so like what if I don't want it?
You might be able to arrange an escrow thing. I don't know how many sellers would want to go for that because, you know, otherwise they're waiting with no money coming in, and there's not too many sellers who can afford to do that. So there are, you know, this way you can write in remedies or how you can get a portion of it back if you can't perform the contract as it's been.
Well, what if it's a two-bedroom condo and Mr. Flanagan's more fertile than he thought, and his wife, instead of having baby one, has now got triplets, and you say this place isn't big enough and you want out, then what happens?
I think they should. You have to get the right to sell it. You have to be able to give them the right to sell it, so they walk away at least whole.
Yeah, so you get your money back somehow.
You can negotiate, and this has always been a title problem because you know it's in this nebulous area where there's no, you know, nothing to indicate exactly how much has already been performed on the contract except the word of the parties involved. And you know, can that be forged? Can that be extorted? Or of course, you know, but it's got risks associated for both sides if things don't work out. But you know, if you've got the ability to negotiate, you've got a friendly seller and a buyer who's getting along with, you can agree just on your own to give up a certain portion of it. The seller will keep this much of it. You get this much of it back, and you can start all over again. But it's, you know, that's an ad hoc kind of thing. There's nothing too standard about it. And that's the risk involved, depending on who you're dealing with. And it may look good today, and something where people's circumstances can change, and all of a sudden it doesn't look like a good deal at all, and either side could be wanting to get out of it and run with the money. So, you know, it's a case for desperate sellers and desperate buyers.
Well, you might be able to do something, though, like I was like, set. So if the rent is $2,000, and let's just say that the $500 on top of that, you could almost set that aside in an escrow account.
Well, that's what I was saying.
For the buyer.
Just like holding earnest.
It's earning interest, so if they sell it, whatever happens, they take that as a down payment or something for their next, or a savings account for their next phase in life.
Right. Or liquidated damages if the contract doesn't work out. You know, there's ways that this can, and the parties, and you should have an attorney if you do this on both sides, believe me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a way possibly that, you could involve a multitude of layers of people of different income stratas. It doesn't just have to be for poor people or whatever. Middle class people, I think, are struggling.
I would love to get one of these things as simple as it could be. I don't want one of these complicated ones. Hey, Art, could you, without changing subjects here a little bit, we were talking a lot about the medical area and how, doctors don't necessarily work for themselves. But you actually, for those that haven't figured this out, because Art deals with all these different people from all these different walks of life, she actually learns a lot about, so does Nancy, and what's going on, and everybody else has used the term business. But what are you finding with, you hit me up with some wild stories about doctors that have joined these groups and essentially were forced to retire that I've sort of tried to recall to the listeners, but I think you could do a better job instead of me interpreting it. You've run into a few people like that are buying houses and now they're retiring or moving or so, where they were doctors and all of a sudden they're retiring because the thing kind of sucked. And we've been talking about that along the way, or where doctors now become employees of these places. Explain that a little bit, will you? Because you've talked to these guys more than I have.
Well, it's kind of interesting, and it's a terrible, terrible reflection, I believe, on the whole medical industry. It used to be, if you were a doctor and made it through the whole process, yes, you came out with some medical school bills, but you could look forward to making a good living, having the security of a profession. And what I complain about to Ten all the time is that these medical groups are nothing but chain stores. And that's where I think medicine went off the rail. And several of my friends in different areas of practice have just said that it's, they don't make a lot of money. And the only reason that they've joined these practices is that the burden of insurance and reporting bureaucracy, imagine that, has made it impossible to run a practice alone or even with one or two people. And this is from established people. This isn't somebody out of school. This is successful doctors who've been in the business for a few decades. And it's very sad that once they're in that, a lot of them did it. Oh, I've got to get my kid through school. I'm raising them myself. It gives me regular hours. Well, then it's like, well, okay, you could have your doctors, but, one week a month, you have to be on call at 5 or 6 emergency affiliates in your system and answer the call for a week. So you're taking a week out of your practice. You have to be available to come in at a moment's notice, or they simply just start squeezing you out and become so onerous. Two of the doctors said they simply didn't have time to be doctors anymore, and one said for the 11 minutes I'm supposed to spend with the patient, what good could I possibly do? And if you don't click off so many, they're after you. So between the litigious aspect of the business from patients, the pushback on the top end, it's kind of like what happens to really good teachers. You're making too much, and all of a sudden the principal's after you and parents are over you. And the pressure forces the top people, I think the people with the most experience that you want, to simply say, you know what? I'm done.
Yeah, it's a... Well, you remember how many years ago, Aud, we had at PTI. Aud is still, by the way, part of PTI. We had how many... Where did we do those seminars where we ended up with... I say we, PTI. We managed money for... Is it three or four medical groups? Remember those people?
Yeah.
And we... This is, you know, back in the early 2000s, and we put... They all had the like ERISA plans and so forth, where the medical group had their own retirement funds for people, and you know people could have their IRAs and so forth, but they ran a regular retirement program. Can you imagine that, John? And then all of a sudden they would join another group and they'd go, you can't be managing this money for people. Right. We're kicking this to somebody and somebody and putting everybody into a 401k, and so. Guys would say, well, we don't want you guys anymore. Well, why? We've done better than all the other people. Well, you know, back in those days, the Protected Index program was doing great. And, we don't want to leave, but these guys say we don't want any responsibility for managing a retirement account from, like, our assistant or secretary or whatever. And I'm going, why not? doing better than everybody else. We know that. So this all started, really, well, this started 15 years ago, right? It started with the retirement plans and so forth. Nobody wanted to do that. We had a big urology group out of Jackson, Michigan. And, you know, we did great for them. And all of a sudden they left. And I go, what are you leaving for? Because, oh, no, these other guys don't want any part of a smaller firm. We don't want any responsibility whatsoever. We're just going to dump it in the Vanguard or someplace. And we go, okay, then. Let them make their own choices. I don't know how that worked out, but, you know. Wow. But
the whole idea of, like, chain medicine is the worst thing that's ever happened.
Yeah.
I think it's caused all the problems. That, you know, no, it's not to blame the doctors. If it was going the money was going to the doctors and nurses and the people that work there, I wouldn't mind, but it's not. It's going to the markups for the drugs and the medical companies and the scams about paying, you know, charging Medicare more and the state paying them back. There's so many scams going on now. It's just frightening.
Well, this is why when somebody comes up with the socialist agenda, and I understand they're looking at the system and seeing that this isn't working. But the idea of we just had somebody else paying for it, the problem is in the system, I think. Do you guys agree or not?
The problem is
in the cost and is the other stuff. And how we went from the doctor being the highest paid person and not even being close, that's a problem, don't you think?
Yeah. And the same thing with lawyers.
Yeah.
Name your profession.
Yeah, and lawyers maybe not so much.
You're just prejudiced.
I
think it's the same phenomenon you talked about, Audrey, where, you know, after a while, you're expected to do things that somebody in their 50s, maybe 60s, isn't interested in doing. And they know this too. They want younger people that they can get in and abuse more than they can abuse you now. So you're just going to walk and do something else or retire early. And you've lost that institutional memory and everything else.
You're absolutely right. But these, you know, it's a shame because you're losing people in the prime of their practice,
right,
who could teach things that you just can't learn unless a lot of the time somebody shows you. It's like anything else. This is the best way to do a suture. This is the best way to, you know, recover, put an organ in, whatever it is.
Best way
it's
to put an organ
sad.
In. I like
it. Four people that have left different practices, and it's really is a loss, not only for their patients, but for the medical field.
Oh, did you just...
A lot of doctors, what they really have that most people would value is their intuition, the things that they didn't learn in a medical text or even in medical school, but they've learned by being on the job. And they understand things over a span of time that a newcomer isn't going to have any clue about. So
That's so true.
So what is putting an organ in his south side for doing a transplant? I love that, putting an organ in.
What do you want? I've had one cup of coffee. Back off.
I think it was terrific, actually. Hey, what do you guys think? We would go over a minute here. Conspiratorially, what if we were to sig a couple of young attorneys like Mr. Flanagan and Lou? I would bet, boy, I don't want to accuse anybody. Yeah, I do. I would bet that if you looked at the price of malpractice that insurance companies charge individuals versus groups, you would find that the discount the groups get is totally non-justified.
And absolutely.
It's almost a conspiracy against the smaller people. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
What do you think you'd
absolutely.
Find?
Absolutely. It's a scheme to drive people out of private.
My question is not the three of us thinking that's happening. I think you agree with that it's happening, right? I mean, I think
I know it's happening.
Okay, but now the question is, if we dug into it, would we find it obvious enough to charge people? And actually,
well, probably.
Criminally?
Go ahead, Odd. I mean,
you could probably if you could find somebody to bring the charges, the pressure from these big medical groups and pharma, as you guys all well know, they have so many people in their pockets. I think it's hard to get where you're going. I mean, that's why I think we need more of the DOGE situations to come in and clean house and say, hey, this is what's under that rock.
Well,
are you going to do about it?
But the DOGE people don't want to go after anybody big. I mean,
they already have, but let's not get into that discussion.
But
the whole thing that they're doing, the concept is of outsiders go looking at something and finally going, hey, what the hell is this?
I think this should be done by whatever, by the department. The question is, it's a violation of the Clayton Act. Then what do? We know it's there. Now nobody seems to want to find any of this stuff. What you just said, you know it's true. That's why I asked you to come up with it. How do we go from there to stopping it, I guess is the question.
Well, you have to find people who are willing to sacrifice their possible political career to do things that most people will not. And that's, if you watch, most of the people that are sitting in office are basically cowardly and want to fly under the radar and get all they can before they ride off in the sunset. That's why we need term limits.
I think, Audie, what you just said, and we've talked about it before, is a dramatic reason why these healthcare costs are this much. We got to go, guys, but it's next time you're on, let's dig into this a little bit more, because it's a serious deal. SP futures up 30, NASDAQ futures up 350. Looks like we have a good day. Bouncing back, Tesla up $5. We got Amazon up $1.70. We've got Meta up $8. So a lot of stuff is up. We'll see what happens. Talk about it tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.